Happy Tuesday, everyone. I don't know if Congress can get their act together and we have the political will to do a digital privacy law in this country, but people are making more noise about it than ever. We've got that. We've got a bunch of AI stuff. And how's it going to affect you hiring? Stay tuned because you're watching Tech Strong Gang. Happy Tuesday. Alan Schimmel here at Tech Strong, and you're watching another Tech Strong Gang edition. Let me first of all introduce you to our gang members for today. Coming at you from the wild urban frontier of San Angelo, Texas, we have our own Amanda Rosani. Amanda, of course, is editor at techstrong.ai and Digital CXO and a bunch of other stuff here at Tech Strong. Hi, Amanda. Welcome.
Hello.
Nice to see you. Amanda, I know you've been traveling and maybe we'll get a chance to talk about it. Joining Amanda and I today, I think he's home in Auburn, Alabama. Go War Eagles.
War Eagle.
The one and only Bacigalup, John Willis. Hey, John, how are you, man?
Hi, guys. What's good?
You're in Auburn, yeah?
Yes, I am in Auburn.
Or at least for a brief time. A
couple days.
Yep. And then joining us, as usual, from our headquarters here in Boca Raton, batting fourth, clean up, Mike Vizard.
Hey guys, how you doing? Good to see everybody as always.
Yep. All right. So guys, let's just jump into what we've got going on today. I kind of prepped it in the opening. I don't believe we have the political will to get anything done in this country, or not much anyway. But Mike, take it.
I think that there's a lot of, shall we say, political machinations at work here. I mean, there's an article in the Washington Post that pointed out that it's not necessarily the Republicans who are stonewalling this for a change. It was apparently they're blaming Maria Cantwell, who's the senator from the great state of Washington, where, as it happens, Microsoft and Amazon and some other folks live. And apparently they've been negotiating this, and for whatever reason, this is the first time they ever got to something that looks like a quote-unquote bipartisan agreement. But the other person on the bipartisan agreement also is from the great state of Washington and a member of the House of Representatives on the Republican side. So it's interesting that we had to get two folks from Washington to kind of come up with some sort of proposal. Now, in theory, it gives consumers more control over their data. The devil will be in the details in that. And so I guess my first question to you is, we've seen like all these IT companies tend to treat whatever data they're given as theirs. So who is the owner of the data and how do you think about managing that?
Well, look, the good news is we have a pretty defined model to base it on, of course, to the GDPR. But here's the facts. For as long as I've been in tech, the tech industry has always had a, let's clean our own house before the government cleans the house. And I think, frankly, that's why it took so long for this stuff to come along. And I think it's also why you see the Washington legislators, involved in this. I'm convinced that Amazon, Google, Facebook, Meta, whatever, and the rest would rather them take care of it themselves. However, they may have come to the realization that they'll get a better deal from the U.S. government than they are from the EU. And so they've enlisted their favorite legislators from the great state of Washington, Huskies, to give them a deal. I think there's a long road between these acts or these proposed laws and actual enforcement. And I'm glad to see this mainstream media behind this. It's not just the tech folks, though we did cover it in Security Boulevard. But from a legal point of view, there's going to, when they did the GDPR, they passed it. So I think it was like 3 years before enforcement ever started.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably going to need similar kind of thing here to put in a similar time frame. Get the kinks worked out of this.
I think there's a lot of foxes standing around the proverbial hen house, but we'll see how that goes right now. Amanda, I want to ask you, do you think that this whole rise of AI is kind of forcing this issue because people are starting to realize just how much the data is valuable, and people are starting to think, hey, you know what? Every time I give up data to these people, they're going to be applying AI against it, and that will impact my experience with them in a heavy way. So will there be more demand from the average consumer and even just regular businesses going, hey, we need to get in front of this thing?
Yeah, most certainly. When you look at the sequence of events, that's exactly what's behind it. But my biggest question is, how many of us don't have all of our data out there already anyway? I mean, so it's good to have these laws and regulations, but I am curious. To me, I feel like I'm just an open book out there anyway. I know some people may be more concerned, but there's just a lot of people with their data everywhere. I mean, our phones are listening to us and our TVs are listening to us. So I feel like it's going to be hard to pull back any of that data that's already there.
Shouldn't we get paid for sharing our data with people who are trying to monetize it for something? I mean, should there be some sort of virtuous cycle here, or is that buried in, as we've talked in the past, the 40-page user agreement?
You know what? I think on a commercial basis, like a Textron, for instance, we should absolutely get paid. But on an individual basis, though, you know, again, it depends, I guess, on the information. But I'm not sure if this digital privacy law, maybe AI is a catalyst in it, but there's more to it than collecting individuals' data for LLMs. This is a long time a coming, right? This should have been passed probably 5 years ago or 7 years ago, and we were thwarted in our attempt on around digital privacy. The bottom line is this: as a society, as a civilization, as a political entity, we have been pretty, I don't want to use the term negligent, but we've been laggards in recognizing the impact that digital information is having on us in total, right? And we're in a catch-up mode now, and unfortunately, this is probably a dollar late or a dollar short and a day late.
Hey, I was going to add just on the LLM side, I think the stakes get really higher. Because you think about the Sarah Silverman lawsuit, but it's even worse than that. Now people are talking about, could employers create digital twins out of their employees? Or this idea that it's not just like deep fake, but what if the consumption of everything you've done, like your code, your logic, your writings, could there actually be sort of derivative work of a digital twin that is you? And then what does that mean for you? That gets really interesting, and it goes back to this. I don't know how they're going to resolve this idea that the argument against or sort of for AI is that it's weights, it's not the data. It's the training weights. So I don't know. But I do think the laziness that we've all had. I agree with Amanda. I mean, I'm out there. We're all sort of social animals, right? We blog, we write, we. So it's not, you can't have it both ways, but that laziness, I don't know, can probably, become harmful to us in ways that we couldn't.
So I John, to your point, I think there's going to be a distinguishment, right? That's what we do in law. They distinguish one case from another. They find a little something to hang your hat on. I think there's going to be a distinguishing point between what we would call a public personality like a Silverman or even a John Willis, perhaps, right, in certain circles, versus non-public, right? And we see this in the libel laws and slander and stuff like that as well. Certainly a Sarah Silverman has a right to the kinds of jokes she writes, the genre or what have you. Do I have a right in Amazon knowing what I'm shopping for? Maybe, but what they do with that information may depend on who I am in terms of a public personality.
And certainly what you're shopping for and then selling that to a data broker has other implications because...
But that's been going on since...
I know. We never got the law straight in the first place.
You know, Macy's did tell Gimbel's.
Now Macy's tells everybody.
Yeah. and that's it, right? I mean, you go on sites now, 430 people have bought this item before. Can you... Well, we start saying, hey, we noticed you're friends with John Willis. Do you know John bought this item before?
I'm not sure, and John, I'd love to get your opinion on this, but I'm not sure we have the tech to catch up with this, right? I mean, if I am feeding data into some sort of LLM, once the LLM sees it, it sees it forever pretty much, and then I'd have to, I can get it out of there, but it's not easy. So I guess my question is, let's say I call you up and I say, I want you to, you know, give me back my data and not use it for all this stuff. Well, you already used it for 1,000 things, so how am I going to pull it all back?
Well, again, that's the, you know, I mean, it, you know, in some ways, this argument that we want to sue OpenAI because it's basically taking derivative work that's been trained on, you know, well, I mean, the truth of the matter is, you know, Google was built on primitive AI, eigenvectors, basically. And like, so like, could we go back and sue Google for all the things? But I think that, how do we get the genie back in the box? I just did a podcast with a guy who works, incredible entrepreneur, and he, Reza Rezpool is his name. He runs this organization. He's sort of retired, he's made a ton of money, and he's creating like personal AI. And this is interesting because, you know, what if you could create your own sort of vector corpus of data about you? So there's this interesting play of like the vector database, which I go on and on about because that's my main interest these days. But this idea of, could I actually create my own sort of personal vectors or embeddings of my information? And, you know, it's very much the way corporations are using the vector databases right now, putting their corpus of data to reduce hallucinations, get more accurate information. You know, what if I could create my own personal? Now, he's got a large hill to climb, as just even though he is a very wealthy guy, but he's building, you know, a 501c around this. And but I think that's interesting because, you know, when we were talking to Facebook and we're talking to Twitter and we're talking, there was really no way. There was some real artificial ways of people trying to lock or brick their phone, or, you know, which, as far as I can tell, it was basically nonsense. But if we could get our own instantiation of our personal AIs, I think there's something interesting there. Maybe we can pull back, because at the end of the day, it's our laziness. And myself is the number one offender, right? Like, I've been participating in all these things. I mean, I don't get my credit cards out and stuff, but I don't, you know, I haven't looked for ways to restrict Facebook and Amazon and Google to break my data, if you will, or if that's the right term. But now I think there is a possibility for us to think about it in a way where we could actually kind of own our own data in the LLM world.
He's defining an entire new market here as we speak. So maybe somebody can do that, because it seems to me part of the issue too is it's not just your data, it's the metadata, and you can start inferring things from different relationships that you may have. And a lot of the people you have relationships with are not public figures. So now suddenly, you know, they should not be able to guess what my brother is up to because we're having an email about something and he's traveling somewhere. That's not...
That is the next frontier here, right? I mean, you know, people have been moaning and groaning and yelling and stomping their feet for a long time about digital eavesdropping, or, you know, Congress just had the thing last week with the FISA and all of this. And we could take it on steroids now.
Look at Uber, right? Like the founder of Uber, that was, you know, they were totally, you know, again, you got this other problem, is these emerging technologies that come out of nowhere and nobody understands what they are. He was actually going after journalists, you know, finding out where he went, what he did at night. They, you know, they literally created an enemies list because they had the, you know, sort of GPS coordinates of where you were going, you know, on a Saturday night or Friday. Like, so we give that up again. Like, if I use Uber, right? Like, you know, I don't know how to get that back, right? If I'm going to use Uber, they know where they have a database. Now, can regulation, like they've sort of done with, you know, the big three or four now, to a certain extent, you know, I mean, Uber got cleaned up, obviously, you know, they got rid of the original founder. I don't know. It's a very complex.
It's a tangled web we weave. We're talking about digital privacy.
Tangled web. Hey, look at that one.
All right. Let's take a break here on TechStrong Gang. We're going to come back. We got a lot of AI stuff. Surprise. John's here. We got a lot of AI stuff to go over today. We'll be back in a second.
I'm Bonnie Schneider, sustainability contributor to the TechStrong Group. I'm excited to introduce you to a groundbreaking new initiative from TechStrong Research, the Sustainability Pulse Meter. The Pulse Meter offers valuable insights into how environmental responsibility factors into tech purchasing decisions for key players in the industry. Position your company as a leader in the industry and differentiate from your competitors with the Sustainability Pulse Meter, offered exclusively from TechStrong Research.
All right, and we are back, and we're going to be talking about large language models and who should be building them, because it turns out within tech circles, this is starting to become a significant debate. A lot of enterprises are thinking about building their own LLMs, and they're going to use data to do that. But others argue that might not be the best use of your resources because, A, the tech is advancing rapidly, and you won't be able to keep up, and your LLM will always be out of date, so maybe you should use a service somewhere. But, John, I don't know if you've been listening to this argument. What's your take?
Yeah, I think the first thing you have to do is bifurcate, like, two things. One is, I think people conflate this idea of, like, you know, the whether you are going to be the one training models. This comes up a lot in the user groups and conferences I'm going now. I think the first thing is who owns the sort of foundational model, the frontier models, and should you be building your own frontier models? I think that's a real dangerous game, right? So there's really one is the foundation of the sort of large models, you know, the GPT-4s, the BERTs, the Gemini, right? Or or augmentation, like something like RAG, or different forms of creating subset training. So I think we conflate this argument about technical debt and overhead. I think it doesn't make sense unless you have a very specific, like, financial model and you've been doing it for years and you have that expertise to start create generalized versions of GPT-4 in your own organization, unless the data is so sensitive that you can't risk, you know. So it's sort of a bifurcation. In other words, I think the right strategy is to stick with a couple of, you know, foundational model vendors, you know, OpenAI, if you're an enterprise, probably Azure OpenAI, you know, Google. I don't, if you want to move some of that on-prem, there's, you know, Llama, and so from Meta, there's this Minstrel. So I think it doesn't make sense for most organizations to start building their own large language model. But the other question that is, should you build your own applications using things like vector databases and different forms of RAGs? I think you should be in experimental mode. You know, I think right now, the fear I have is that an organization with the next year will have, 100 different sort of co-pilots or chatbots from different vendors. And those vendors, not the big monster vendors, are going to have the same technical problem you're going to have, keeping up with the changes. And so now you've got, like, a horizontal spread of, like, technology that's a minefield. And how do you SRE it? How do you sort of manage it? So if every vendor comes in with their own chatbot, which they're doing already, you know, we can pick on a couple, like PagerDuty, Workday's going to have one. They're all going to have one. You're going to have that technical debt. And then the question is, again, not to pick on, I'm using PagerDuty as a great example. Could I write my own incident analysis LLM with a foundational model and use a vector database and some open source tools to create my own version of what PagerDuty does for the vector database? I still have PagerDuty. It's a great product. Or do I use their out of the box and then suffer that I don't understand how it works, I don't know how to fix it, and I hope that they can keep up with the changes in the technology as fast as I would. And so it's why we've adopted open source, right? We went from proprietary solutions because the proprietary vendors couldn't keep up in a pre-generative AI world. You know, imagine how well they're going to do in a post-generative AI world. And so we went to open source because at least we had a fighting chance. So I think there's it's a more complicated question other than just buy versus build, or technically.
Well, that's why we have John on the show, because he gives us lots to unpack. So let's start. Is there a middle ground, John, with can I run a foundational model that's from an open source organization, but then I'm extending it with my own LLM capabilities? Because these things are not all or nothing propositions. It seems like somewhere between just using RAG and building my own LLM is a middle, where maybe I can just extend that foundational LLM with my own custom LLM that kind of sits on top of the open source one. Is that feasible?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest problem, we've talked about this in prior discussions, the biggest problem right now is the sort of frontier models, as they would call them. The models themselves are not open source, right? Like, and what that means is how they were trained. What is the code they used to train them, right? I'm not sure that's a problem, because I don't think you could, you know, it cost $100 million to train GPT-4, right? Like, so I don't know that that's a problem per se. I fake being an expert on this subject. I don't know if there's a viable open source model that you can personally train yourself, that I'm sure there are, but I would probably still stick with what I would call the proprietary models. But to your point, the middle ground is I should be building a lot of stuff myself right now. We're in a discovery mode. And so I can take these foundation models, and chances are I'm not going to train them anyway, because I don't have the expertise to train them. I don't have the resource to train them. Let me use them at their foundational basis and then do all the things at RAG and all these sort of localized, you know, the beauty of RAG is, you know, vector databases and all these other variants of it is you don't have to train a model. You don't need somebody that knows the complexity of training a neural network. They're very plug and play. We're running hackathons now where people are building in one day things that blow your mind. Things that would take a year, 2 years to build. We had a hackathon recently, a set of doctors, clinicians, and healthcare specialists. None of them were actually professional IT, or they knew how to code. And they built a thing called Chappie in one day, which is basically a climate healthcare bot that was, it's out there right now. It literally answers questions about, it came from the New York smoker cop apocalypse. They wanted to like really build around that. I actually happened to be there that day. I was at DevOps Days New York. So I was concerned. I got in and asked it questions, and it gave me research. So the point is, there are a lot of opportunities that you should be exploring about building your own sort of corpus of data, your own LLMs, but you don't have to worry about, in general, training the foundation models. You can pick a variant of the top training models. The fact that they're not open source, unless you're the, you know, DOD or somebody who really can't risk data escaping, I think that, you know, it's just hybrid.
I'd like to weigh in here if I can.
By all means.
So, you know, whether we're talking about AI or DevOps or security or anything else, I always like to tell people, when you enter the room, don't leave your common sense at the door, okay? And the rules, you know, the physical rules of the universe still apply. When it comes to should IT teams build LLMs or not, of course they're going to need LLMs, and they'll need custom LLMs to, you know, get beyond just whatever, you know, ChatGPT-4 or whatever it's in there. You want your own LLM. The issue is that LLM, the information in it, and how's it going to be used by the organization, is it core and critical to the organization's mission? If it's not both, outsource it. And I think you are going to see the rise of LLM builders as a service, right?
I kind of disagree, Alan, a little bit. Just
okay.
I think there's a lot of, I think we're in a discovery and learning phase right now. And again, if you take the distinction between, I definitely agree with you, I should outsource the foundation of frontier models. Like, I don't want to be building those things, right? You know, unless you're a superpower ML ops organization that's been doing this for years. But I do think right now that the risk that you run is that if you outsource the low-hanging fruit, you're going to have, that's where the real technical debt tsunami is going to come to play. You're going to have all these vendors that gave you these chat ops and co-pilots that on their surface, they can't even keep up with the technology with their own product, let alone now they've got to deal with the changes that are happening. And that comes, you inherit that technical debt. So I think you're almost, and I don't know who's right here in the end, but I think you're almost better, you know, taking off the low-hanging fruit to learn this technology, understand it. But the key then is you're not building your own LLMs. You're augmenting, you know, retrieval augmentation, those kind of forms, or localized training, which is a lot simpler, of the foundational models. And you're learning how to build your own solutions, you know, and unless it's a vendor that you really trust and you think they've really nailed a particular space that they're just gonna, it's their core to keep that up, then maybe outsource it. But I don't know.
This was playing out at the Google conference when we were there, because, and that was last week, because they were making a case that said that there should just be one kind of master agent that is going to orchestrate all the security workflow and do that for also DevOps and all the other categories, versus John's point, if every quote unquote platform vendor has its own agent, and then you got to stitch all these agents together to execute something, it gets a little unwieldy, and then everything's kind of out of sync. So I think there's a big vendor platform battle at play here between all the people who are part of a quote unquote IT service management solution, who all are going to build their own little agents. And then the fact that, to John's point, I don't want to manage 20 different agents. I just kind of want one that's kind of an Uber agent. So I don't know how it's going to play out, but it seems like that's where the war is going to be.
And I want to add to that. I was just at the NTT Upgrade 2024 conference, and they're looking at it a little bit differently. Instead of large language models, they have something called Suzumi. I think that's how you say it. And they were taking like small language models, or very, very small large language models that do very specific tasks. And each one of those very specific chain tasks came together as like a big interconnected web of tiny large language models. And so that was pretty interesting, the direction that they were going.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the key is architecture. And again, this is why we're, you know, we're writing in paper as part of Gene Kim's projects called Dear CIO, which is, the people who are ultimately going to have to support these things are going to have to learn the technology as fast as possible. We're also going to have to start creating, like, have stack conversations. Like, what is an architecture of these things? Like, what is, you know, already we're talking about things like, you know, orchestration, observability, and RAG, right? And then, you know, like, are those three the new LAMP stack, right? And then, are we able to then sort of, at least for the people, because like, here's an example, right? Like, if every one of these chatbots that you bring in over the next year or so have their own vector database, then what is SRE going to look like, right? Who's, you know, so the question would be that sort of whoever, SRE, DevOps, or infrastructure and operations, you know, the sort of the right-hand side of the CIO's, you know, purview is, can they ask a question, hey, vendor X, you're bringing in this chatbot or this co-pilot, what vector database are you using? Oh, we're using Pinecone. Well, we kind of support two. We support Milvus and MongoDB. Is there any way you can make it work with the two that we support, right? And have those kind of conversations happening so that at the end of the day, it isn't just, because, you know, the bigger problem right now is everybody thinks this, you don't need infrastructure operations. You don't need DevOps, because AI will solve that. It'll answer all your questions. But I think what we're going to find is if we don't do the principal things we've done, you think about what happened with cloud. It was, you know, with cloud, we first ignored that it was going to be owned by the CIO. Then data operations and data science, we ignored it. It all came back and it had to be managed. And this is just another example of stuff that's going to have to be managed at scale in the infrastructure. And I think we're going to have to, you know, the sort of the DevOps to the rescue, if you will. I know it's short-sighted, but we're going to have to. We're going to ask those questions. We're going to have to ask, you know, like, what's your stack? What orchestra are you using? LangChain, or are you using LambdaIndex? What version are you using?
And to John's point, there's this other argument going on about, you know, the AI models grew up with a bunch of data science teams doing everything, but increasingly it looks like the inference engine deployment side of that is moving over to the DevOps folks, the data engineering pipeline for sending data to them becomes more of a data engineering motion, which also melds with DevOps. So a lot of what we're calling
DevOps is dead.
Oh,
yeah, there you go.
turns out that a lot of this MLOps stuff needs to kind of, half of it needs to shift over towards more of the DevOps mindset, sure, and let the data scientists build the models and not the rest of the stuff.
Agreed.
Guys, we got to take a break here, though. That's what my DevOps people are telling me. We'll be back in a minute. We're going to wrap up with our last block on Might AI Transform Hiring for Better or Worse?
All right, folks, now we're shifting the gears slightly, but we're talking about AI and hiring, and I think anybody will tell you that if they've gone looking for a job, they pretty much hate the whole process. And the root of the problem has been perhaps an over-reliance on key search terms and resumes, and that's what people look at, and then they use that in the HR department to figure out who should they interview. And not everybody's great at optimizing their resume for a particular set of keywords that somebody's looking for. And so a lot of good candidates never get interviewed in the first place. There's also a bias in the resume process because a lot of good candidates don't have four-year degrees, but they have a lot of experience, and that doesn't really manifest itself in a resume. So there are folks now talking about applying various types of AI to rejigger this whole process in a way that will result in a better pool of candidates coming through, because there's a lot of people applying for various jobs and they're not all well suited for that either, to be fair. But I want to run a little clip here from an interview we did with Karim Kermili, who's over at Flatiron, and he's going to talk about why he likes hiring people who don't have four-year degrees, because it's about experience more than it is about their degree. So let's run that now for a couple of minutes.
I've seen a lot of young graduates or engineers without a formal college degree who have just self-taught or coming from a boot camp, and they're very good at some of these technologies like JavaScript or Python, mostly web technologies. And also, I guess, mobile technologies as well. So some of the other more complex bits might be challenging. But I've actually witnessed a lot of engineers learning by themselves or just following tutorials on the internet and then working at smaller jobs, slowly working their way up. They've actually been they were some of the more successful engineers that I've seen, in fact, because when they actually learn by themselves, they're actually gaining a very important skill. They learn how to learn by themselves, which puts them ahead. In other words, comparing two profiles, if I had two resumes of a 25-year-old engineer, one of them went to college at 18, studied computer science until 22, and now he has 3 years of experience. The other one, let's say they did not go to college and they did some boot camp at 18, and then they started working at a job at 19, and they've been working for 6 years. I would actually go for the 6-year experience one because they're more experienced in the field. They might need some help, and definitely we need to like do a more careful interview process because the college degree actually promises like a few of qualities that you might want to be more careful about if you're going for a candidate without a college degree.
Amanda, let's go with you. I know you've been tracking this AI, HR kind of space for a little bit, but what's your sense of what's happening here and how quickly might it happen?
Yeah, absolutely. So as companies turn more toward AI and different various automation tools, they really are missing the big picture. And oftentimes they're scraping things from the resume. The resume doesn't include everything or all the experience or maybe wasn't filled out correctly. So it's not catching everything. So we just recently posted an article on TechStrong AI about a company called Sapia AI. And they're trying to solve this problem by getting more human and personal and finding a way to interview everyone who applies for a job using this AI. And they each get an interview and the AI uses all the data and filters through it and gives them feedback as to why they were or were not right for the job and kind of helps them understand what jobs they are a good fit for and what jobs they aren't a good fit for by scraping through all that data. So it's a little bit more personal and it helps both the employer and the potential employees know what jobs they should be applying for and better understand the people that they are hiring more so than just their skills and experience, also their characteristics, their personality and things like that.
You've hired a few people over the years. What's your
been fired? look, this is a great example of how AI can be a game changer for good or bad, honestly, right? Can AI do away with resumes, which I find are the biggest waste of times I've ever seen? I mean, having looked at people's resumes and then interviewed them hundreds of times, the resumes aren't worth the paper they're written on if you get them in a written in versus electronic. That being said, I worry about AI bias built in, right? Because in a way, look, AI could take the bias out. We don't care that this person had a 4-year degree because it's like doing draft evaluations for the NFL draft, right? You can equalize things. So, okay, this person has a 5.3 on their experience factor and only a 2.2 on their education factor, and that's a blended score of 3.6, and that's my sweet spot. But it also can have biases in there, and it can perpetuate those biases, and it can be gamed, right? Just like, until you can prove to me it can't be gamed. And so we need help, and you speak to any HR person and they'll tell you they need help in finding qualified candidates, and oftentimes the prereqs are, from the moon. And AI can help us do that. But like everything else with AI, the promise is there. Let's see in real life how it works. That might be a very different story, I'm afraid.
John, you've been floating around this IT hiring issue for a long time. What's your sense? Can we get to a point maybe, I don't know, I just want to, here's my job description, and then I want something to come back and tell me, here are the 20 people out there that are best suited for this, and are they available?
Yeah, I think, in that video, right, the gentleman talked about what they're doing internally. I think like code, using AI for code reviews, using code for sort of the analysis of did the product deliver, what it stood at. So, there's been a lot of companies over the years, especially in the DevOps space, where they literally, if you're coming in as a coder, they ask you to code. They literally want you to Jira ticket and try to get you to do something. There's some of the more innovative, the Facebooks that, we literally code during the interview. And not that there are other jobs, but the point there is think about the acceleration then where I can literally have you work with an AI tool, like a co-pilot, and ask you, so now I get to see how creative you are how much you can produce in like a 30-minute interview process, where before I had to give you a very small subset of code and I didn't have that much time to really find out how good you are. Now I open you up to, hey, can you solve this in 30 minutes? I think you can also do that for, you know, the whole idea of the natural language processing of these things is it can accelerate the conversations that you might have. The key point of all of this, like all of the discussions we've had in all the segments today, is I think there's always a human in the middle. And so we never need to lose sight of that. So could we use a tool? There's a friend of mine working with one of the big four providers of services, right? And they're building for a really large corporation something that literally sends you, and you have to send in an interview, and you record yourself, and it actually can figure out from the nuances of what you said, how you referenced, whether you might be a good initial candidate to bring in, right? That's way better than like the resume. But resumes are nonsense. And every once in a while, I get a request for a resume. I've been doing this how many years now? Like a resume? Are you kidding me?
Resume, John.
I don't even know what one looks like, you know? And if you're asking me for a resume, like we're really not having the right conversation. So that idea that if you ask me like, hey, can you go ahead and explain why I know we're going to run out of time quickly, but I always loved how Netflix, if you came in and you didn't understand the Reed Hastings deck, like it was a showstopper. You know, Adrian Cockcroft would say like they knew right off the bat that if you didn't even read that or understand what he was talking about in the culture deck. So imagine you could build that into sort of an LLP as part of send in your interview why you want to work here. Now you still gotta, and then maybe if it's a coding position, I can ask you to say, hey, what can you build this in, 30 minutes? And we could even have a conversation about like a DevOps or organizational design NLP or LLM, right? But at the end of the day, it's the humans that are going to sit around and try to decide. So again, there's that. I think this augmentation is like an incredible opportunity. I do think on the degree side, though, one thing I did want to add is I think that it's the more and more I get into this AI stuff, the more I realize how much I wish I would have paid attention to math early on. I really do. It's kind of weird. It's making incredibly complex stuff easy to use for everybody, but beyond the surface level, I'm having to dust off a whole lot of things that I haven't really thought about in 40 years, So I do think I think a solid education shouldn't be a litmus test. Experience should always win, but I don't think it's time to dump the.
I agree. Technical jobs, you need technical training, but a good solid education. And a base will help you in life beyond
any
one job. Guys, we're about out of time, though. That's going to wrap up this version of Tech Strong Gang. Have a great Tuesday. As usual, Wednesday, we'll probably be running a repeat of a best of Tech Strong TV. We've got a full day of Tech Strong TV, though, following the gang here. So stay tuned for that. But until then, this is Alan Schimmel. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.
Cloud Native Now is the web's leading resource for the growing cloud native ecosystem. CloudNativeNow.com is your destination for news, thought leadership, features, and webinars on cloud native architecture, Kubernetes, serverless, cloud native application development, microservices, service mesh, cloud native security, and more. Stay on the cutting edge of modern application development at CloudNativeNow.com.